Just that's why we always need one of you engineers around. That's just miraculous. I'm going to be cramming too much material into the two lectures this morning. There's really no way I can do it all. But I'm going to take most of this first hour to talk about Dostoevsky the man. And the reason I'm doing that is I sincerely believe that this is a literary figure that we need to know about and have some grasp of. Personally, I view him as the man, the writer after Shakespeare, who has the greatest grasp of human nature. What makes human beings tick? He has remarkable insights. He also stands against the mainstream of most modern literature. But he is so fair in his treatment of the big arguments that have engaged the world in the last 150, 200 years that almost everyone can claim him. He is so fair to the different points of view that he has been claimed by almost every possible camp. Although I'm going to make the claim this morning, it's very clear which camp he's in and what he himself held as his own belief. I should give a little warning, however, and I do think this is important. I was going to check this, and I haven't, so I'm running on memory. And as you grow older, you'll find out memory not only plays tricks, but finally just leaves you altogether. So I can't swear this to be the case, but I think this is the case. I seem to remember in Dr. John Senior's book, The Death of Christian Culture, a very fine book, a remarkable man who did very good work, God rest his soul. He has a list of moderns that he doesn't recommend reading, and I think he puts Dostoevsky on that list. And I can understand that, in that Dostoevsky was a man who was immersed in the modern world, understood that world, and tried to give a depiction of what that world was like. When Dostoevsky holds the mirror up to nature, the world he is reflecting is a world of modern horrors, of insane thoughts, of misdirected beliefs and understandings, of uncontrolled human passions, and for that reason, it can be an extremely dark and disturbing world. Dostoevsky, therefore, is not for every reader. It is certainly, Dostoevsky is not for young people to read. And while I would have no qualms giving young people even something like Macbeth to read, I would hold off probably until the college years before I gave them some of Dostoevsky's works. They could probably manage Crime and Punishment when they were still in high school. That is probably doable. Some of the others I would wait till a bit later. And particularly, there are things in Notes from Underground that are for more adult readers, not necessarily for high school students. So that's a little caveat, and that's just a matter of what's appropriate at a certain time, and that's also just simply a question of what is it that Dostoevsky is reflecting. And there are some readers who simply cannot bear him. I have a colleague who is a good reader, a good literary man, a thoughtful man, Novus Ordo Catholic, but a believing Catholic, who has tried to read Dostoevsky and says he cannot do it. As he puts it, all these crazy people with their uncontrolled, insane passions said it makes him so nervous he has to put the book down after a while. And reading a little bit of Notes from Underground, I'm sure you have a sense of this. For a certain kind of reader, this is pretty heavy stuff. And many simply can't take it. That's a matter of taste, and it may not be for everyone. But I'm going to make the claim here that he does indeed do something remarkable. Dostoevsky was born in 1821. He was the only major writer of the first part of the 19th century in Russia, a period of time that produced a number of significant writers. He was the only one not to come from the landed gentry. He came from the sort of from the middle class. His father was a doctor and had married a good woman. It was a happy marriage. His father was something of a stern disciplinarian, but nothing out of the ordinary. And it was a close family. It was a very close family. He had an older brother he was very close to for all of his life. The older brother died in the 1860s, and it was a blow that Dostoevsky never quite recovered from. He himself gives this depiction of his family, quote, "I came from a pious Russian family. In our family, we knew the Gospels almost from the cradle." And that was something that would simply stay with him, that special love that he got very early on. He made another comment where he said that they knew the lives of the saints before even beginning to read. Their mother, a particularly pious woman, not only read scriptures to them, but read lives of the saints. That was the world he grew up in. Disciplined world, that was what was in the family. His mother died when he was fairly young. It was a difficult loss for him. He loved her very much. In 1839, at the time that Dostoevsky had been sent off to an engineering and military academy, this just kills me. Knowing a little something now about military and engineering academies, I read over the curriculum of what Dostoevsky studied there and wept. His time there, he took the following courses. At the Academy of Engineers, okay, where he also received military training to become a military officer, he studied religion, history, civil architecture, European architecture, Russian language, Russian literature, French language, French literature, German, art, history, portrait drawing, and a course in architectural drawing. That was in addition to his engineering training. Just, oh my goodness. But in the midst of all of this, as he was receiving all this education, he began to believe that science and engineering and reason were not sufficient to unravel the human mysteries. He decided while he was at this school that he hoped to make his fame and fortune by becoming a literary man. He wanted to be a writer. And even though he began in the military and served some time there, he focused his energy and attention on writing, as did his brother Mikhail. The reports of him as a young man is that he was almost pathologically shy, a bit removed, a bit distant. He had friends, but he was a bit of a loner. And he underwent a severe trauma in 1839 when his father, who had some estates out in the country, was murdered by the peasants on that on the estate. It was shortly thereafter that Dostoevsky began to suffer from bouts of epilepsy. There is a famous essay by Freud again. His name keeps popping up, you notice. He's commented on almost everything, usually idiotically, claiming that it was the loss of the father that caused Dostoevsky's epilepsy. He makes a direct one-on-one link and says the reason for that, of course, is because the peasants had done what Dostoevsky really wanted to do, which was murder the father. I mean, it's the usual Freudian pattern. I think we can say that, stretching it a bit. He did take certain things from his childhood, okay? As I said, a sense of the secure home, the happy upbringing, and although a disciplined upbringing. In one of his later works, he says, if a child has one happy memory from childhood, then that child can endure almost anything in later life. It's a fascinating notion that children need something to hold on to as they grow older. he had a solid and, as he said, a very happy childhood that lasted for some years. One little story from his childhood before we move on to the later years. He tells this story repeatedly on a number of occasions. As a young boy, he and his family had gone off to the forest on a little vacation. And he was walking in the forest alone when he suddenly heard some peasants in the distance screaming that a wolf was loose and rampaging through the forest. He was terrified and saw a peasant man working in the field, and he ran up to the peasant who was plowing. And the old peasant man smiled and comforted the boy and told him not to worry. And the peasant man said, "You may go home now with the assurance that I will keep you in my sight. I will watch you all the time you're heading back to your home, so you need not worry." And then as he sent the boy off, he made the sign of the cross over the child and said, "Now Christ go with you." And made the boy cross himself as well before he left. And Dostoevsky describes the confidence with which he then returned to his home, even though he knew there was a wolf wandering around. So it's a story that stayed in his head for a long, long while, and something that had a profound influence on him. When he became a writer, he made clear why he wished to write and what he hoped to do in his writings. I quote, "Man is an enigma. This enigma must be solved. And if you spend all your life at it, don't say you have wasted your time. I occupy myself with this enigma because I wish to be a man." It's a wonderful statement. It's a wonderful statement. That exploration took him places that many writers would not go. He wanted to understand the full range of what it meant to be human, what human beings were like, and he came to be especially obsessed with the enigma of the irrational erupting out of seemingly reasonable men. Remember, this is coming at the end of sort of the triumph of the Age of Enlightenment, the notion that men are reasonable and rational. Romanticism was going to have a huge effect at this time in Russia. I'll say more about that later. But he came to understand that it wasn't just a matter of emotion that could seize a human being. It was often irrational, uncontrollable, and destructive forces that existed in the human personality that could explode forward at unpredictable times and create genuine problems in the world at large. Before he came to explore that in depth, however, he was absorbed in that idealistic, romantic vision that was coming from Western Europe. Many of his heroes were European figures. For example, Schiller, the great German dramatist. He read a number of French writers, profoundly influenced by Victor Hugo. And he began to think that, began to be obsessed with what was very typical at the time. And that was that there had to be social change. The poor were oppressed, and therefore it was time to do something about it. And he became connected with a group of young men in St. Petersburg who had revolutionary intentions. Now, I need to distinguish something here that's extremely important. There were two, I'm going to call them revolutionary groups because they really both were. But there were slight differences between the two groups. There was a group who called themselves Christian socialists. The influence came largely from the French utopian socialists who had Catholic underpinnings. One of the heroes of this movement, and one of them who defined it, was a man named Lamennais. Father Ascara can tell you much about this man. You've probably bumped into him already. He was hugely important and became a major figure in Russia and came to be a figure that Dostoevsky detested. Dostoevsky in his writings is constantly attacking Catholicism. It can be something of a problem. But what I found puzzling for a long while when I was reading Dostoevsky is that his depiction of Catholicism always seemed to me to have more connection with the Vatican II Catholic Church than it did with my sense of what the Catholic Church was about. And what came clear to me after a while, particularly in reading this long biography of Dostoevsky, is that his vision of Catholicism came out of these French utopian Catholic socialists. And he had this skewed vision that what the Catholic Church was interested in was social reorganization, social justice, to the neglect of the spiritual life. There's a really unpleasant comment he made once about a Catholic priest and how he saw Catholic priests working. Listen to this, because, this sounds Vatican II to me. The Catholic priest searches out some miserable worker's family and gains their confidence. He feeds them all, gives them clothes, provides heating, looks after the sick, buys medicine, becomes the friend of the family, then converts them to Catholicism, and he goes on to say, ignores the mystery of Christ's suffering and sacrifice. The love of charity is reduced to material goods and comfort. Stern criticism. It reminds me, for years, I live up on the second floor of an apartment. Below me was Catholic Charities for the state of Maryland. And the people in and out and things going on, never any prayer, never any sense of a devout. It was just handing out checks. It was just bringing in money and handing out checks. It was a very uncomfortable situation for a long while. So on the one hand, you had those who were, if you will, adapting Christian charity to socialism. This was the group that Dostoevsky became connected with for a while. He obviously turned against it later. There was a second group that was moving beyond socialism to outright atheism and insisting that there is no God. We have no particular reason to be charitable to each other other than self-interest. We're going to come upon this in the second lecture, talking about Notes from Underground. The reason to be kind to others is a kind of egotism that then extends out into the way we treat others in the world. It's based on Kant to a large degree. But it is an open atheism. These were the two groups battling in St. Petersburg. They often interconnected. Dostoevsky was more connected with those who had some Christian underpinnings moving toward socialism, but he himself felt he had gone so far that later in his life he spoke of himself as having fallen into atheism. To simply take a vision of Christianity as being charitable to others, to him, was essentially to be on the road to atheism. And the neglect of the spiritual life was to limit one's understanding of what the faith is about and to be moving away from any belief at all. During these years, and we're talking the 1840s, he wrote his first novel called Poor Folk. And it's just what one would think. It's a naturalistic novel about the sufferings of the poor. It was extremely popular. He was acclaimed as a major literary figure right away, largely because his writing was directly in line with what was being put forward at the time, what was popular intellectually. This is going to become hugely important in the Notes from Underground. This notion of intellectual fashions, what's popular at a given time, and what ideas you line up behind simply because they are fashionable. He began hanging around with an openly revolutionary group, and in 1848 he participated in the printing of some revolutionary pamphlets that he also helped to see distributed. He says openly of himself, "I was converted to socialism and atheism." There's some question if he actually went that far, but he himself makes that claim. He says that he participated in subversive activity. And in 1849, he was arrested as a revolutionary seeking to overthrow the state. He describes how well treated he was during the arrest and following that time when he was convicted and sentenced. This may seem like a small detail, but what we have to do is compare the treatment the revolutionaries got in the mid-19th century with what erupted in that same country once the communists had taken charge. And again, I refer you to the Gulag Archipelago. It is fascinating to do a comparison between what happened to the revolutionaries. In fact, the most curious vision of that is that after Lenin was arrested, and he was arrested and held in prison for a time, he had a very comfortable room, he had a writing table, and he wrote some of his most provocative works while under arrest, under very comfortable circumstances. Perhaps one can see that now as a mistake, but it does tell you something about the nature of that, what was called the oppressive system of justice. Well, Dostoevsky never complained, but he said he was indeed well-treated. However, he was condemned to death along with the other revolutionaries. He was sent to Siberia. The day of the execution was set. That morning, hoods were put over the men. They were walked outside. The executioners lined up, cocked their guns, and Dostoevsky was prepared to die when the reprieve came from Tsar Nicholas I. They were forgiven. It was the turning point in his life. And as he said, having faced death, he now had to take life seriously. He viewed those years up until that point as a kind of game playing, kind of intellectual game playing. And that confrontation with death was very important. But something else happened. They were sentenced to spend some time in Siberia. He accounts that in, there are excerpts from it in this volume for those of you that have it, fascinating book called The House of the Dead about his prison years. He arrived at the prison where he was to serve out his sentence to discover, as he went into the prison, the wives of many of the other prisoners who were standing outside the prison. They had gone there with their husbands, couldn't see their husbands, were inside. Were under lock and key. The wives lived in the area, lived together outside the prison, and those wives pleaded for the new prisoners as they were led into the prison, and then blessed the prisoners, gave them copies of the New Testament. And he said he remembers getting the copy of the New Testament, and as he walked into prison, these women, wives of prisoners there already, making the sign of the cross over them again. Another moment in his life, it obviously reflects back to that moment with the peasant in the woods that I spoke about. A special blessing being put on him. Now, Dostoevsky was indeed a Slavophile. He loved Mother Russia. And there was this tension throughout his entire career between two schools of thought in Russia. Those who were deeply attached to Western Europe and the Western European tradition, and those who believed that that tradition was polluting Mother Russia, that Russia had its own special mission, its own special intellectual gifts, its own special role to play in the world, and that role was quite apart from what was going on intellectually in Western Europe. And in fact, he openly attacked what he called Russia's captivation with the West. Why everything, unquestionably almost everything that we have, of development, science, art, civic mindedness, humanity, everything, everything comes from there, from that same land of holy wonders. He's being ironic. Why our entire life, even from very childhood itself, has been set up along European lines. He viewed it as a mistake. And part of what he tried to do was establish some sense of Russian literature. He loved Russia and the Russian people, and up until that point, when he entered prison, he had set up the Russian peasant as a model of what a human being should be. This is something you will find everywhere in the Russian literature of the period. Turn particularly to the novels of Tolstoy. I spoke briefly about Tolstoy yesterday afternoon. Every peasant who appears in any work of Tolstoy is a noble peasant. You cannot find anything other than a noble peasant in Tolstoy. It's like those poor in Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. If you are poor, you are good. The less money you have, the better human being you are. Until the point, if you're reading the Grapes of Wrath, you find these people detestable. And if you've got any sense at all, you come to realize, I'm sorry, human beings are not universally good just because they don't have any money. There is a tendency toward this in Russian literature of the period. But peasants are noble, good, solid, wonderful. Dostoevsky had bought into that until he got to the prison and spent some time living with some of these peasants. And what he found there was that the peasants indeed, on an individual basis, could indeed be noble and good. But they could also be morally degenerate, corrupt, insensitive, brutal, and awful. And it came clear to him that it was impossible to make sweeping generalizations about mankind in terms of any class or group of people. And that revelation is extremely important in terms of his later artistic work. Human beings must be taken one at a time, one on one. Each personality, each soul is unique. And one cannot generalize in that way. He himself was a driven man. He was constantly in debt because he was addicted to gambling. He was one of those men that could not get near a casino, could not go near a roulette wheel. He had a sense that, it's an addiction, what can you say? And he was constantly in debt. The most fascinating depiction of this severe addiction is in his short novel called The Gambler. And in that work, he explains better than anyone ever has what drives that kind of human being who is addicted to that sense of making a lot of money very fast because Dame Fortune is going to smile on you when the wheel spins. It's a fascinating work, well worth the reading. He came out of the prison, with this new knowledge, his new understanding of human nature, and also with the firm belief that a Russian revolution could not take place, that the entire revolutionary movement was a serious mistake. He quotes at one point a commentary from Pushkin. Pushkin says, God save us from seeing a Russian revolt, senseless and merciless. Those who plot impossible upheavals among us are either young and do not know our people, or are hard-hearted men who do not care a straw either about their own lives or those of others. Absolutely accurate depiction, and again, it's something that Dostoevsky came to believe in, and the time in the camp destroyed his humanitary faith in the basic goodness of the peasant class and those around him. He came to understand there is an evil in human nature, and it can touch every human heart. His understanding, I think, of the human personality and his ability to depict it comes at this point. He came to understand that the human personality, each individual human being, has a need to exert that personality in the world, to somehow find its place in the world, or to make itself known in some way in the world. This of course, this is a little prologue to Notes from Underground. That voice may be coming from under the floor, but it's screaming at us. It's demanding our attention. And that human personality is going to demand some kind of autonomy, some kind of freedom to express that will. He came to believe that it was perhaps the strongest drive of the psyche, and that to fulfill this drive, the exertion of independence and autonomy, individuals proving that they are free and can do what they want and can be guided by their own will, that men will sacrifice all other goods and values. And if they are unable to satisfy it in any way at all, the results can be disastrous. It is for this reason he felt that there has to be some higher ideal in order to guide that will, to shape the human personality, to give it some order. Here's a quote from the great biographer of Dostoevsky, a man named Joseph Frank. His biography isn't finished yet. He's been working on it for about 30 years, and 4 volumes have been published. The final volume isn't out yet. He's now retired. He's in his late 70s. I hope he's granted time to get it finished. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. But this is Joseph Frank talking about Dostoevsky. Not to believe in Christ and immortality is for Dostoevsky to be condemned to live in a senseless universe. And the characters in his great novels who reach this level of self-awareness inevitably destroy themselves because, refusing to endure the torment of living without hope, they have become monsters in their misery. There are those all the way through the novels who are modern men who say no to the truth. And again, it's an assertion of their autonomy, of their free will. But they absolutely refuse belief. And as a result of that resounding willful no, it's a great quotation, they become monsters in their misery. Let me quote Dostoevsky's own commentary on his own belief and where it comes from. This is one of the most famous things he ever wrote. It was in a letter to a friend. This came after his first rather unpleasant marriage. He married a widowed lady who was not in good health. It was while he served briefly as an officer after getting out of the prison camp. And during that time, it was a troubled marriage, and she died just a few years after they were married. But it was around this time that he began clarifying his own beliefs, and he wrote in a letter to a friend the following: "I will tell you that I am a child of the century, a child of disbelief and doubt." That's how he characterizes the 19th century. That's what for him the 19th century was about. Disbelief and doubt, and says, there is wisdom here, we tend to be children of the time in which we're born. It's difficult to escape that. I will tell you, I am a child of the century, a child of disbelief and doubt. I am that today, and I know it will remain so until the grave. Can never quite shake this off. I will never quite be free of it. How much terrible torture this thirst for faith has cost me, and costs me even now, which is all the stronger in my soul the more arguments I can find against it. And no one has ever made better arguments against faith than Dostoevsky. I'll talk about the brothers Karamazov in a moment, but those of you who know it, the arguments of Ivan Karamazov against God are powerful arguments. The arguments that the Grand Inquisitor makes in that extraordinary scene, the poem written by Ivan, powerful arguments. The more arguments I can find against it, that is faith of any kind. And yet, he says, God sends me sometimes instants when I am completely calm. At those instants, I love and feel loved by others, and it is at those instants that I have shaped for myself a credo where everything is clear and sacred to me. Please notice, he is a child of the century. He has to come up with his own belief system. He has to devise it himself. This credo is very simple. Here it is: to believe that nothing is more beautiful, profound, sympathetic, reasonable, manly, and perfect than Christ. To have a 19th century thinker come out with something like that is extraordinary. To put it mildly, it goes against the flow. And I tell myself with a jealous love, not only that there is nothing more than Christ, but there cannot be anything more. Even more, if someone proved to me that Christ is outside the truth, and that in reality the truth were outside of Christ, then I should prefer to remain with Christ rather than with the truth. It's an ironic comment, of course, because he knows Christ and the truth are one. But the fact being, there cannot be truth other than Christ. If one had to choose, one would have to choose Christ. Because Christ is everything. Christ is everything. It's extraordinary. What this also did was change his worldview. Completely altered his worldview. From being a revolutionary seeking to overthrow the state and elevate the peasant classes to the proletariat and, okay, all of that socialist nonsense, he suddenly becomes an open defender of the Tsar. This is a comedy made about Tsar Alexander II. God grant happiness to the magnanimous sovereign. More faith, more unity, and if there is love as well, then everything can be done. The vision of the Tsar as the representative, the earthly, he believed in hierarchy. He came to believe in authority. All of those things set him, of course, directly against the major intellectual thoughts of the time. The one aspect of Christian thought that he emphasizes throughout all the novels is that the only possible way to unite oneself with Christ, the only possible way to find anything like comfort or joy in this world is by suffering. And suffering becomes his obsession. At a time when the whole human race is believing that the world exists to make it more comfortable, that science exists to explain everything, that materialism will provide for us human comforts, and that if we are fat and happy, then life will be good, this soul voice rises up and says, no, the truth is Christ, and the truth of Christ is suffering. And to unite ourselves with Christ, we must unite ourselves with him by suffering. As a result, the novels are filled with examples of figures who have to undergo extraordinary suffering. Often figures who can begin to attain to some measure of truth within this insane modern world by that very suffering. Notes from Underground, which I'll talk about in the next hour, is the key, the gateway to the last great novels, the five great novels at the end of his life. This was the way in. Many people view it as the kind of prologue to that, because most of the major themes are here. He's begun working with them. But I'll just say a very few words about those five novels. I recommend them to you. They're worth the reading. The first, and in some ways, maybe the best known, of course, is Crime and Punishment. There are two great works about an act of murder and the conscience in literature. One is Macbeth and the other is Crime and Punishment. There is, however, a difference between the two. And it's a significant and profound difference, which is why the two works can be looked at together to great advantage. Macbeth is a character with a conscience who performs an act of murder and as a result kills his own conscience as well. As we witness Macbeth after the murder, we see that conscience die in him. And that imagination that was so alive, that guilt that haunted him as he prepared for the murder, committed the murder, and just after the murder, he has to repress. He has to get control over, and as he does so, he kills his very soul. Ironically, his wife, Lady Macbeth, who had no such conscience, who was able to say immediately after the murder, a little water clears us of the deed, is a woman in whom conscience suddenly comes awake and finally drives her mad, the great sleepwalking scene. So you get that strange contradiction between the two characters. In Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov, who commits the murder, seems to be without conscience. Before the murder, he comes up with very good, very rational arguments as to why he is entitled to kill the old pawnbroker. That she is of, he has about three or four different reasons. I won't go through them, but basically, he is very logical. He is very rational. He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows the why of it. He is not touched by conscience. He commits the murder, and we see the birth of that conscience, and then the coming to faith, the coming to faith, as he begins to act out and be haunted by what he has done. It's an absolutely brilliant piece of work, and I highly recommend it. The Idiot, the second. Interesting novel. It was Dostoevsky's attempt to create a good character in literature. He made the following observation, is absolutely true, that most of the great and memorable characters in literature are evil or at least touched with evil. That the most difficult thing to do in literature was to create a good man who is also an interesting character. He claimed that he thought there was really only one person who had done it hugely successfully, and that was Charles Dickens with Mr. Pickwick. And Dostoevsky adored Dickens, but particularly loved the Pickwick Papers. And Mr. Pickwick was a favorite of him, of his, because he said Dickens had actually created a man there who is good and interesting. He tried to do it in The Idiot. He creates this figure called Prince Myshkin. Opinion is divided as to how successful he is. The novel, however, is populated with dozens of fascinating characters. It is worth the reading. The next novel was called The Possessed, The Devils. This current very good translation is simply called Demons. Interesting. The problem in translating the title comes from this. The original Russian word means not only those evil spirits that get inside and take control of you, but then also what they turn you into. So that the possessed doesn't quite do it, because those evil possessors are also included in the title. The devils comes closer, because the devils can come in and possess and then turn you into one of them, and you become a devil as well. Demons I rather like. It covers the territory in one word. That's it. It is indeed a vision of the coming of the revolution in Russia. It is about the young revolutionaries. I'll say more about this in a moment. It is a vision of that idealistic, romantic generation that handed on sloppy thought and sloppy ideals to the younger generation, who then became nihilists and didn't believe in anything other than burning everything down, other than breaking open cash machines at Woodstock, okay? Just absolute nihilism. There is no order, there's no belief, nothing at all. And it's not just a revolution for the sake of high-mindedness. In the group are those who are simply out to destroy. Simply out to destroy. That's all they're interested in. The other thing that Dostoevsky grasped in this novel was that when the revolution erupted, he wrote this novel in the 1870s, okay? So we're talking nearly 50 years before the Russian Revolution. But he's predicting it. He's saying it's coming. And he is showing the why of it. He made the statement that it would be a catastrophe for Mother Russia, because it would end up with a totalitarian, evil, destructive society, government, state that would destroy its own citizenry. One of the characters, there is an uproarious meeting of the radicals in one chapter. It's called Among Friends. They're all lunatics. I mean, even down to the emancipated women who are there just railing and screaming. I mean, he was on to that long before any of the others, and realized that this was going to become a movement as well. They're there screaming their heads off. People are getting up presenting their ideas, which are just nonsensical. But most interesting, one of them, Shigalov, who's the radical theoretician. He's the one who's going to give the theory behind the revolution, makes the following statement. I got entangled in my own data, and my conclusion directly contradicts the original idea I start from. Starting from unlimited freedom, I conclude with unlimited despotism. I will add, however, that apart from my solution to the social formula, there is no other. He shows the insanity of the thought processes. And indeed, Shigalov, the argument is there, you can follow it and you can see how it works. Every man should be free, he begins with. By the end of his argument, Well, yes, every man should be free, but if every man is free, then there has to be some government at the top to keep absolute control over all of them. And that's the most important thing that will define us. Oh, that contradicts my original premise. Well, that's the only way it can be, so there you are. They are boneheads. They are absolute boneheads. But they took over. They succeeded. And Dostoevsky knew that they would win. He makes the statement, it's in that same scene, if socialism takes control in Mother Russia in the next century, 100 million heads will roll. Solzhenitsyn quotes that comment in his Gulag Archipelago and says, and they laughed at Dostoevsky, and they were right to laugh at him, because he was wrong. It was 110 million heads that rolled. Typical Solzhenitsyn irony. But precisely the point. Yeah, he was wrong by 10 million heads. There were 10 million more heads. That's the number who were slaughtered. And he saw the bloodbath coming. He knew what was coming, tried to give a warning, and no one heeded him. But of course, that's the reason, as I said yesterday, during the years of Soviet rule, you couldn't get a copy of this book. The Soviets would, I mean, it was sort of underground. You might find it occasionally. You could not have walked into your local communist bookstore and bought a copy off the shelves. This was not a popular book. A little red novel that's quite wonderful called A Raw Youth, sometimes called The Adolescent. I recommend it. Story of a young man growing up in this mess and trying to figure out the way to, trying to find his way. It's a wonderful book. It has one of my favorite jokes in all literature. For about the first 50 pages, the young man is announcing that he has come up with a great idea. That the only thing that defines a man is the man must have a great idea. And he's thought about it for, the kid's 17 years old, 18 years, he's thought about it for a long while and he's examined the world and he has finally come up with his great idea. And his great idea will transform him and transform the world. And his great idea is, I am going to become a Rothschild. I want to become a banker and make lots of money. It's uproariously funny. It goes on from there. It's a fascinating book, a very good novel, written between Demons and the Brothers Karamazov. It's of some interest. And finally, of course, the Brothers Karamazov. What can you say? Worthy to be named in the same breath with Oedipus Rex and Hamlet and the gigantic works of literature and Don Quixote. It is of that caliber. The curious thing about this novel, it was supposed to be the prologue to a longer novel he was going to write. The Brothers Karamazov is 800 some pages long. It's an extraordinary book, but that was just to be the introduction to the book that was to follow. We don't know exactly what that book was going to be. We have a few hints. We know the title of it was to be The Life of a Great Sinner. And beyond that, we don't know a lot. However, the prologue that exists, that volume he did finish just before his death in 1881, is one of the gigantic works of Western literature. Let me just say this, if you want to read the book, I don't mean to schematize the novel, because you can't do that. But the brothers, those four brothers, whose story is told throughout that novel, are in a way different types of human being that define us in our completeness. Dmitri is the man of the senses, okay? Ivan is the man of logic and reason, and cold-hearted rational man. Alyosha is spiritual man, the one concerned with the soul, and Smerdyakov, the illegitimate bastard son, is original sin of some kind, of some really slimy kind. He's the one that the good lieutenant commander mentioned yesterday, whose left foot is, deformed on the left side, as are so many of those evil characters in literature. And then the two fathers, old Fyodor, who is just a swine, but often rather funny, and an unbelievable portrait of a self-indulgent man. well, what can you say? And Father Zosima, the holy man, the holy monk. So, you know, you have the earthly father and the spiritual father. And then you have that array of women, not to leave them out. But let's just say you can't categorize them. They are as complex, unpredictable, and fascinating as women in the real world. Dostoevsky said, and I think this is really just a key to open all the novels. God and the devil are fighting, and the battlefield is the heart of man. It's a wonderful comment. God and the devil are fighting, and the battlefield is the heart of man. A number of very famous statements from him. The one from Brothers Karamazov. If there is no God, everything is permitted. In that one statement, liberal niceness is done away with in one sweeping truth. If there is no God, then we can't all just be nice to each other. If there is no God, there will not be an ordered world. If there is no God, there's no way you're going to build utopia here. And he knew it. And the fact of the matter is that it's a fact. If there is no God, then there are no rules. You can do whatever you want. And this last one, lovely statement, but you have to be Catholic to fully understand it, I think. He said, beauty will save the world. And of course, for him, that beauty is Christ. And that beauty, of course, is connected with truth, it is connected with the good, but in a world becoming rapidly materialistic, and scientific, losing any sense of the beautiful. It was the beautiful that often he stood for and fought for, and that he was able to show in the most unlikely places. Now, the novels are great and polyphonic in a way. He is absolutely fair to every argument, as I said earlier. And those novels are filled with grand arguments and huge discussions, and he will not weight the dice in the favor of his own personal beliefs. In those combats between the characters, there is real weight and substance given to contrary arguments, and they are embodied in fascinating human beings. So that we know what Dostoevsky himself believed he wrote about it, but his vision of how that is being worked out in the world as he presents it in the novels is extraordinarily complex, okay? One final comment talking about the world that was coming, and he just refers to it as the socialists. The socialists want to have man reborn to free him, to imagine him without God and without family. They conclude that having forcibly changed his daily economic life, they will attain their goal. But if man is changed, it will not be for external reasons, and not otherwise than by a moral transformation. You will not abandon God until you are convinced by mathematics, and the family until mothers do not wish to be mothers, and man wishes to turn love into raw sex. So he's saying that's the only change you'll get. Can you achieve this with weapons? And can one dare to say beforehand, before the experience, that here lies salvation? And with this, this future socialist vision, and with this, risk all of humanity? This is Western rubbish. Strong stuff. Brings me to my last point. He was convinced, I'm going to try to draw a distinction here. He was a Slavophile. He loved Mother Russia. There are times in the novels he gets going about Mother Russia and people falling and kissing the earth that seems to be a bit much, okay? It's not something we're used to. Although, at the same time, he could make the statement that the earth is soaked from the crust to the core with the tears of the suffering. Extraordinary vision. And as he said, for some reason, God had chosen Russia to be the place of suffering. Now, he wrote this before this 20th century, when a punishment was visited on that nation that to this day we cannot comprehend. To read the Gulag Archipelago and get a sense of what happened to those people and that nation for the better part of the 20th century is to be nearly overwhelmed with destruction, horror, but most importantly, suffering. And Dostoevsky's point was that suffering of the Russian people would be used by God to a great purpose, to a great end. It is very interesting, as I said yesterday, that in our century, in our time, in 1917, before the revolution, the Blessed Mother appears at Fatima and is talking about Russia. That Russia will spread her errors throughout the world. That what's going to happen in terms of destruction in this century will be from errors spread by Russia, but that Russia will also be somehow the source of the conversion. As she says, the Holy Father must consecrate Russia to my Immaculate Heart. He will do so, though it will be late. Russia will be converted, and a period of peace will be granted to mankind. Near the end of Demons, one of the characters, I don't want to give away the plot, you must read it, it's a great novel. One of the characters who is responsible for much of what has happened is dying, and he is making a good death. He is beginning to make some sense. He's gone off on a journey. There is a woman with him who is the gospel woman. She goes around handing out gospels. He asks her to read a passage from the gospels. Now a large herd of swine was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them leave. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then people went out to see what had happened. They came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how he who had been possessed with demons was healed. My friend, this wonderful and extraordinary passage has been a stumbling block for me all my life. So if I remembered this passage ever since childhood, and now a thought has occurred to me, it's exactly like our Russia. These demons who come out of a sick man and enter into the swine, it's all the sores, all the miasmas, all the uncleanness, all the big and little demons accumulated in our great and dear sick man in our Russia for centuries. But a great will and a great thought will descend to her from on high as upon that insane demoniac and will come out will come all these demons, all the uncleanness, all the abomination that is festering on the surface, and they will beg of themselves to enter the swine, and perhaps they already have. It is us and them, and I perhaps first at the head. And we will rush, insane and raging, from the cliff down into the sea, and all be drowned, and good riddance to us, because that's the most we're fit for. But the sick man will be healed, and sit at the feet of Jesus, and everyone will look in amazement. Dear, you will understand later, but it excites me very much. You will understand later. We will all understand together. The image is, God will heal Russia. Russia will sit at the feet of Christ. Russia will be converted. The world will be amazed, and a period of peace will be granted to mankind. Our Blessed Mother's own words, for some reason, Dostoevsky was given a little glimpse of this profound truth, and helps to explain it to us.